Okay, let's start that again. Page 16 of the sheet, which we didn't get to last time, and page 17 is an extract from Rav Aryeh Kaplan's book, Immortality, Resurrection, and the Age of the Universe. We have that book in the library, I'm pretty sure. It's well worth a read. It won't take you that long to read it. The book deals with all of those topics in great detail. And as I said to you before, everything that Rav Aryeh Kaplan wrote, you should read. It is absolutely fundamental and very worthwhile. And he has a very kind of a bit of a wacko suggestion 50 years ago. And maybe it's not wacko, maybe it's absolutely mainstream, I don't know. But this was 50, 60 years ago. He was a physicist, you should know. There's an interview where he died very young, in the 80s, in his 40s. 1980s in his age 40s. But he was interviewed by, what's that program in America? 60 minutes, 40 minutes, 50 minutes, 60 minutes. There's like a 60 minutes interview from the late 70s, early 80s, where they interviewed him because he was already becoming quite well known. As I say, he was a scientist. He was a brilliant, brilliant Talmud Chacham, a world-class Talmud Chacham. His knowledge of Kabbalah was unbelievable, and what he writes is so clear, the footnotes, etc. So I really strongly recommend you to read everything that Aryeh Kaplan wrote. And he suggests that it could be that Tchiyat HaMetim could be achieved through cloning.
What? Cloning.
He says that the idea that we... And he challenges whether it's going to be necessarily miraculous, because he said things which are miraculous are not long-lasting, and Tchiyat HaMetim is a long-lasting thing. He quotes the Kabbalistic sources, and he suggests that all we need is the DNA of somebody who died, and then we'll be able to clone them and to put them through some kind of 3D printer. This was 60 years ago. This was a long, long time ago. This is before Jurassic Park and all that kind of stuff. And therefore, what we'll be able to do is we'll be able to create people, obviously as babies again. Hashem will give them the soul, meaning when we create babies today, we just do the physical stuff and we rely on HaKadosh Baruch Hu to put the neshama in. So if it works for the normal stuff, it works for Tchias HaMesim, we'll just remake Great Uncle Harry and he'll be a baby. And now, because the question is, he's not going to grow up like Great Uncle Harry in the 1940s, because he's going to be born in the 2030s or 40s, but he's going to have the same neshama, which is interesting. He even goes so far as to say, and I think this is brilliant, what if you can't find any DNA? Can't find any DNA. What are you going to do? So he says, got a solution. He says, that is the purpose and job, potentially, of Eliyahu HaNavi. Eliyahu HaNavi is a Navi. He knows what Navim know, and therefore all you need to do is, you don't need the DNA, you just need to sit Eliyahu HaNavi down at the computer console, and he will type in the DNA pattern, because he's the Navi and he's got the whole DNA pattern, and then press print, and then Great Uncle Harry comes off the 3D printer. So I'm not saying this is right, I'm not saying this is wrong, I'm saying this is really interesting. I'm saying he wrote this like 50, 60 years ago. I mean, he died 40 years ago.
Rav Aryeh Kaplan?
Which is what he said?
He said yes. And he was a scientist. Yes.
They have that with AI right now. They're putting people's
People what?
Die, their whole personality is put into
Okay, and when you put an neshama into that, you begin to realize that what was science fiction 30 years ago, even 5 years ago, is science fact potentially today. So again, I'm not suggesting you that's the only way that Tchiyas HaMetim can happen, but there may be other alternatives than the kind of zombie revolution coming out of the graves. That's all I'm saying, that whatever it is. Yes.
Get this from
millions of first of all his sources are encyclopedic. He knows, I keep finding more books that he wrote. He knows in depth books that most people haven't even heard of the book, and he's written like translations of them and footnotes on them. So I would advise you to go to the library and open up, start with the Handbook of Jewish Thought. There's two volumes, a pink one and the other one. And you just keep going down the rabbit hole with him. And he only lived till he was in his mid-40s. But he had encyclopedic knowledge of everything. It's clear. And he grew up as a Baal Tshuva. He was not even religious. He wasn't brought up in a religious home. They discovered him in the Lower East Side when he was, I think, 12. His father passed away and he needed to say Kaddish. He was called Lenny. And they brought him in. Lenny Kaplan, and someone taught him to say Kaddish so that he could say Kaddish for his father. And then they realized within a very short time that they had a genius. sitting in front of them, and they and then he went on from there, which is really amazing. So you could I taught his great granddaughter, or maybe his granddaughter, like 20 years ago, and she didn't know really anything about him. It was a remarkable, you know, and because you know he died when she was very tiny, and maybe not even born, probably not even born before she was born. Okay, anyway, that's not for now. But I brought you that at the bottom, and you can read that in your own time. And I strongly advise you to read other things from Rav Aryeh Kaplan. The next thing I want to talk about is for a few minutes on Gilgulim, which we didn't talk about. So please turn to page number 7. Let's talk about Gilgulim, reincarnation. Now, reincarnation is different from resurrection in the sense that it is a rolling process. Resurrection, Tchiyat HaMetim, we usually think of as a kind of one-off. Meaning the usual way we see Tchiyat HaMetim is that when the world is coming towards its messianic goal, maybe during, maybe before, maybe after, but in that end of days, then people who are not fortunate enough to be around to experience that messianic world, which you can sit and do mitzvahs and whatever, or in Gan Eden, whichever version of the Mashiach world, the messianic world you hold, then people who were not fortunate enough to still be alive can be brought back to life and can be part of that. Gilgulim is different, because the word Gilgul, what's the word Gilgul literally mean?
A wheel.
It's a process of going around and around and around and around. In English... This is sometimes called reincarnation, but more specifically, here's a word that you can get to know and love. It's called metempsychosis. Okay, metempsychosis. It's nothing to do with psychosis. It's nothing to do with people who are psychotic at all. It's a Greek. It's from meta, beyond, in the soul going beyond in something. Okay, so that is the official word for Gilgul in English, metempsychosis, and it is absolutely central to Kabbalah, meaning the world of Kabbalistic thought, and we'll talk a little bit about where that world kind of comes from. Reincarnation is absolutely central, and I'm going to bring you, there are entire books on it, classic traditional books, but I've just brought you one paragraph from the Ramchal. The Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzater, who of course was a Kabbalist, he lived in the 1700s. He was coming in the wake of the Kabbalah of Svat and the Arizal, okay, and Rav Chaim Vital. We'll talk a little bit more about them. And he was about 100 years late. So look at number 13, please. So in Derech Hashem, are you guys learning Derech Hashem this month? No, probably not. But Derech Hashem is also on your must-to-do-to-read list. You have to read Derech Hashem. We've got many copies. It's in English. It's the Hebrew is very accessible. The Ramchal was a very interesting person. As a young man in middle, he also died very young, by the way. He died at 40. He was very persecuted in many ways by all sorts of people, in the Jewish community as well. People were worried that he was going to be a new kind of Shabtai Tzvi. He was an incredible Kabbalist, and he wasn't that, but people were very nervous about it. But the Ramchal became, after he died, adopted by all the major 19th century brands of Judaism. The Litvaks, the Vilna Gaon, saw him as an amazing teacher and said he would have crawled on his hands and knees to see him if he could have done. He died long before the Vilna Gaon was born. The Hasidim adopted the Ramchal as one of their kind of founding texts. And also the Haskalah, the non-religious Haskalah movement. He was also a poet, the Ramchal, and he wrote plays and he reinvented modern Hebrew. Modern Hebrew didn't come from the Zionist revival it came way before that. It came in the late 1700s, early 1800s, when there was a revival of Hebrew as a modern language in the Haskalah, and the Ramchal, of course, was even before this. So have a look at the Ramchal in number 13. Od shoresh acher, there is another root, nimtza, okay, lahanhaga b'inyene, inyene olam hazeh. How does God run this world? There's another system he wants you to know about. For who, and this is works as follows, Shehachochma ha'elyona, the higher chochma of God in how he runs the world, sidra laharbot od hatzala k'moshe ketavli. There are other ways which God can help people, save people, and intervene to get people to perfect themselves, he's going to say. Sheneshama achat, because one neshama, tavot la'olam hazeh, can come down to this world, pa'amim shonot. many times, begufim shonim, in many bodies. Okay, the soul is something from the higher level world, from the world of Atzilut, from the world, the godly world of the Sfirot, and the soul is able to be sent down in many different bodies. Because of this and through this, what's the purpose? Tuchal letaken bepam achat. You can perfect in one of your gilgulim et asher kilkila bepam acheret, what you messed up in another one. And this is extremely central because the Arizal, and just to give you a little bit of a timeline of Kabbalah. Okay, Kabbalah, according to Kabbalah, is very ancient and comes already from the time of the Tanakh and from the time of the Chazal, etc. It didn't really surface until later. And you can decide whether, you know, you want to understand it this way or understand it that way. But Kabbalah, as we know it today, the Jewish mysticism that became Kabbalah, really started surfacing in the kind of the time of the Gaonim, maybe in the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th century. There was a book called Sefer HaYetzirah, which became a foundational text, and then a book called Sefer HaBahir, which was a little bit later. And you have a flowering of this first in southern France, and then in Castilla, in Spain, in Girona, in Barcelona, in places like that. And you have figures like the Ramban, Nachmanides, who was an early kind of proto-Kabbalist. And then you have this explosion of Kabbalistic mystical thought in Castilla. Did I say Castilla before? I meant Catalonia. Catalonia first, and then Castilla. And you had a book that was produced at the end of the 1200s called the Zohar. Yeah. And the question is, where did the Zohar come from? And there are different approaches on where the Zohar came from. Was it an ancient text preserved in its entirety? Did it start its core was an ancient text, and other things were added onto it? But certainly by the end of the 1200s, the Zohar exploded onto the world scene. And I'm not giving a whole sheer now in the origins of the Zohar and the different theories and how it came about. And even within the religious world, there are different approaches on that issue. Yes?
Yes, so it's not just a great...
No, it's not just a straightforward agreement that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai wrote the Zohar. There's a lot more to say on it than that. And there have been many svarim of the greatest of the greats published over the last 700 years discussing and debating and bringing evidence for this issue. This is not just an academic issue that came up in some, you know, Jewish studies department in, you know, 1906. This is something we've been talking about as a Jewish people for 800 years, and there's a lot to say about it. But leave all that aside, the Zohar exploded on the world scene, and that has Gilgulim as a key point. Then there was a revival of Kabbalah in Sfat. After the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492, many of them went to the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire captured Sfat together with the rest of Eretz Israel. It captured Eretz Israel in 1517. And Sfat then became a place where Jews could return to. They felt almost a messianic reality because they'd just gone through what they felt was Gog and Magog, like a holocaust of the terrible persecutions in Spain. They then fled to the Ottoman Empire, and almost miraculously, just after they arrived in the Ottoman Empire recaptures Eretz Israel. And the Jews, for the first time in hundreds of years, are able to come to Eretz Israel. So Sfat, and many of you have been to Sfat, maybe all of you have been to Sfat, became a new home of Kabbalah. People like Rav Moshe Cordovero, who wrote the Talmud Devorah, and many other things. People like Rav Yosef Karo, who wrote the Shulchan Aruch, and was also a top-level Kabbalist. And then the Arizal, Rav Yitzchak Luria, came from Egypt to Sfat and became probably the greatest Kabbalist of that era. And him and his students defined what Kabbalah would be for the next 600, 500 years. The Arizal died in the 1570s, I want to say, so it's around 500 years ago. And Rav Chaim Vital, his student, then spread Kabbalah on other students too. One of the main focuses of the Arizal's Kabbalah was Tikkun. Tikkun. Meaning in the Arizal's world, when the world was created, first of all, there was a tzimtzum that God retracted in his essence, her essence, its essence. I don't like God being pigeonholed into gender at all. God's essence was retracted so as to make a space in which the world was created. And like every part of every stage of this has a course to be. And Rabbi Ansel Forsyth has been talking about this as well, and you can get his classes too. And then what God does is God reintroduces creation into this space. That then falls apart, something called a shvira. There's a cataclysm. There is a crisis in which the original system, by design, collapses, and then the rest of history is tikkun. It's putting everything together again, and everything we do, therefore, in this world is part of that tikkun in the world, in the Kabbalistic world of the Arizal. And therefore, he says, when a soul is able to achieve what it can achieve in one life, it needs to be mataken, it needs to perfect, and then perfect, and then perfect, and you get as many bites of the cherry as you can get in order to bring that tikkun, that you can do everything you can possibly do. So he says as follows, you can perfect in the next Gilgul what you didn't do in the last one. Third line, Ola hashlim, or you can totally, you know, not just fix, but fill totally, mashelo hishlima, what you hadn't done before. V'ulam, however, b'sof kol ha-gilgulim, at the end of all of these gilgulim, the din shel ha'atid lavo, in the final judgment that will come, hini hadin, this din will be yiyah aleh kefi kol ma she'avar aleh min ha-gilgulim she'nitgalgala. All of these gilgulim will be part of that judgment together. Umin ha-matzavim she'haytabav, and all the things that happen to them. V'hine efsha she'yigia inyanim la'adam. Therefore, he says, things can happen to a person in life, Shinishmata Magulgelet, and his soul, her soul, is a reincarnated soul. Kifimashi Yugrumla, and the reason they're happening to this person is because of some cause, mitzat masha asta the Gilgul Kodim, of what happened in a previous Gilgul. The Yinatsin La Adam Hahuba Olam Matsav Kifizet, and therefore a person might not understand why their life looks like it looked. What have I done to deserve this? How did I, you know, deserve this so good or bad, whichever state you're in? U kafia matsashi natsin lo yiyah hamasa asher yutal alav. However, what you are left to do in this world is to fix up whatever was needed in the you didn't get in the previous Gilgul. And therefore your life is set up according to this system, according to things you could never have known about. But they were designed in that way. In an extreme form, this could be presented as a reason why a child, let's say, would nebach get sick and die. What possible thing could the child have done? The child, by definition, religiously speaking, can never have done anything wrong. Why would this child have died? So, of course, we never know in any specific case. But the system would say, of course, because this child is not just a child. This child has been here many times before. And maybe all that was left to perfect was one small thing, and that child was able to do it. Maybe even a child that lived 3 or 4 days and brought some simcha to his parents or her parents and then died. That was all that was left to do. For that smile that they brought to their grandparents' face was all that was left to do, and then they were a perfected soul. Now, you can't obviously prove any of this in any kind of empirical way, but from a Kabbalistic point of view, this system is absolutely central. And every single one of us, for many, many, many hundreds of years, have been Gilgulim. It's rare, extremely rare, that a fresh soul gets drawn down from the system of souls. All of us have been here before, and there were Kabbalists all through the ages that were able, or claimed at least to be able to look at you and talk to you and tell you and identify who you are a Gilgul of. Okay? And the Rav Chaim Vital, who wrote down the work of the Arizal, has a sefer called Shar HaGilgulim, the Gate of Gilgulim, where he goes through all through Tanakh. This one was a Gilgul of this one was a Gilgul of this one, etc. And of course, you could be a Gilgul of somebody who was a different gender. You could be a woman with a neshama of someone who used to be a man, or the other way around. What that means, I've no idea. How that works, I've no idea. Is that got anything to do with transgender? I've no idea. No idea. But in theory, the neshama can be present in different ways. And then you end up, to a second, with like neshamas kind of grafted on, sort of joining for a short time and then leaving again. And that's called an ibur, like a pregnancy. You get someone's neshama for a while and then it goes. And then you end up in the whole world of the dibuk, of negative forces that get joined on temporarily, and then positive, you can get a tzaddik, and it becomes a very complicated and elaborate but very central theme. Yes?
So, this idea, like, where do we see it in the original, like, prophecy of Moshe?
Okay.
And also, like, how do we know that we're not all just one soul being recycled over and over?
Well, we are on a certain level. Like, Pi Kabbalah, all the Jewish people are one connected mega soul. Mm-hmm. It's called Knesset Yisrael, which connects with Malchut in the Sfirot, and we are all one big connected soul. There's no question. You feel like a separate soul, but on a certain level, you're not. Mm-hmm. From the ultimate God level, everything is just God. Even the Rambam, who is the most not Kabbalist you can think of, mm-hmm. says that God knows everything about you because God knows himself, and in that sense, you are part of that reality of God. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. But what did you ask at the beginning? Where is it in the Torah? Okay. Is this referred to in the Torah? Not explicitly. But having said that, Tchiyat HaMetim, resurrection, is also not explicitly in the Torah. Okay? It doesn't have to be explicitly in the Torah. But it's definitely a mainstream part of Kabbalistic thought and Jewish thought today. There is a mitzvah that seems to feed itself very well into Gilgulim, which is the mitzvah of Yibum. What is the mitzvah of Yibum?
Spitting the shoe thing?
You
well, that's Chalitza. That's what everyone knows about. That's like that when it goes wrong.
If he dies.
Right. Boy meets girl. They get married. He dies with no children. She then has to marry the brother of the husband because their first child will bring back the name of the dead brother. Now, on a certain pshat level, it means that there'll be like a child in memory of the dead brother. He'll inherit the money of the dead brother, and he'll be brought up by the uncle. But al pi Kabbalah, what's happening is the neshama of that dead husband is coming back through this first child. And that's very central to this. Yes. So that's a mitzvah in the Torah. It's not explicitly about Yibum, but it seems to hint in that direction. Yes.
A non-Jew's part of the system?
I don't know. I don't know how it works in terms of non-Jews. I'm not going to speculate and guess. Okay, yes.
When people get married and they say that the person you marry is the other half of your neshama, how would that fit in with the world?
So this is, well, first of all, people say all sorts of things when people get married because they want to make people feel good about getting married, okay? And even if they think the marriage is a probable disaster, they still say nice things under the chuppah. So the people who say that, not even wanting to put a damper on it, don't know that. Meaning they're not coming from some, if some a couple says to you, meets you and your husband and says, look, I can see that this is actually a neshama that was fine. But like someone stands up and says at Sheva Brochas that the gematrias of your names match to a posik, like that doesn't prove anything. However, the fundamental idea, that husband and wife are the reconnection of the original split, that man, from the Midrash says already, and the Kabbalah really picks up on this, that man and woman were created as one creature but facing away from each other, and what you need to do is peel them apart and bring them back together again, that transition from what's called back to front is absolutely central to creating, you know, the future and the spiritual reality. So anytime a man and a woman come together as a marriage, it is a realization of that reconnection of the original soul of Adam and Chava in a way which works. Whether there's such a thing as a besher, there's one guy out there who is your split soul, I don't know about that. I suspect that people overblow that. I don't think there's necessarily one person you can marry, da, 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 da. But that's not the point here. The point is that marriage itself represents that, and that's what we talk about under the chuppah. They're the brachas under the chuppah. Yes, Imuna.
So if somebody, like, during the resurrection, is everything going back? Is it your last life or is it this life? Like,
don't ask me any details. I don't know any details. There may be Kabbalim that do know details. Kabbalah is a very real thing. I must tell you, as someone who's been studying a bit of Kabbalah, quite a lot of Kabbalah for the last 4 years, I really feel that it fits together very well. It just takes you through all these ideas and psukim that you thought you understood, reconnects them in a new kind of pattern. You think, wow, how could that not have been obvious the first time? So I think Kabbalah as a system is incredibly integrated. And I give you a moshel. Imagine that you went through your whole life reading the Tanakh and you'd never heard of Halacha, you'd never heard of Gemara, you'd never heard of the Oral Law, and you were an excited Jew just keeping the Bible. And you lived in a desert island somewhere as a fully committed Jew. And then someone came up to you and said, that's great, but what about halacha? What's halacha? What about Gemara? Look at the Gemara. Look what it does with all these psukim. And you open the Gemara and you go, oh my goodness, it's like a whole new dimension that I never... So imagine that with Kabbalah. It's like a whole... No, I can't give an example because I'm not prepared to share on Kabbalah. I could if I started thinking about it. But again, Rabbi Ansa Forsythe has been teaching and will be teaching on this kind of thing. There are hundreds of examples, thousands of examples. I'm just not going to give you one random one. But they fit together very well. However, here's the however. Even though the world we live in is very Kabbalistically oriented, not everyone was a Mekubal. The Rambam never mentions Gilgulim. He never mentions Gilgulim. Doesn't mention it. How does the Rambam deal with things he doesn't agree with? He just doesn't mention them. Now, it's possible that the Rambam didn't ever hear about Gilgulim. I doubt it, though, because for Sadugon, we're going to see right now, who was a real source for the Rambam, talks about Gilgulim, but the Rambam doesn't feel it's, you know, worth his while even talking about it. Having said that, the Rambam never mentions Mashiach ben Yosef either. Now, Mashiach ben Yosef is a big topic in the Gemara. The Rambam for sure knew all about Mashiach ben Yosef. He even gets you all excited. And he says in the Mishnah Torah, he says, and the Torah talks about two Mashiachs. And he brings from Parshas Bilam. He look at the prophecy of Bilam at the end of the Parsha coming up. It's like it's a dual thing that God will do this and he will do this. And he will do this and he will do this. And he will do this and he will do this. And it goes in pairs. And the Rambam says, yes, that's because there are two Mashiachs. And you get all excited. And think, oh, he's going to talk about Mashiach ben Yosef. He says, and who are they? David HaMelech. And Mashiach ben David. David did this, Mashiach ben David will do that. David did this, Mashiach. And you think, oh, what a letdown. I thought you were going to talk about Mashiach ben Yosef. But he doesn't. Okay? So, does that mean anything? It's an interesting question. But I wanted to see you, Rav Saadia Gaon. Look at the top of page 8. Look at the top of page 8. Says, who was Rav Saadia Gaon? Rav Saadia Gaon wrote Emunas V'Deus, which was the first major text of Jewish Hashkafa. He's living in the 9th century. He's one of the greatest, if not the greatest, of the Gaonim. Okay, a major figure, a major source for the Rambam, a major source for Jewish thought in the Rishonim. And he says as follows, number 14. Nehinini Oimer, I want to say to you as follows. Ki anashim, there are people, mimisha nikraim Yehudim, who call themselves Jews. Okay, yeah, right. Okay. Matzatim, and we found that they what? Ma'aminim begilgul, they believe in Gilgul. The Korim also hayat kut, like a copying, okay? And how does it work? And he's living like in the 9th century, before any of the Kabbalah came into the scene, into the open. The inyano, how does this work? Leda'atam, according to them, Ruach Reuven tiyeh b'Shimon. Ruach Reuven, the spirit of Reuven, come back in Shimon. V'achakach, and after that, b'Levi, it can come back again in Levi. The Achakach be Yehuda, and then it can come back again in Yehuda, again and again, rolling along. Umihem or Rubam, and there are some of them, maybe even most of them, Sovrim Shiyesh, that there are situations they think Shetzia Ruach Adam beBehema, that the man, human, can come back in an animal. The Ruach Behema and the spirit of an animal can come back beAdam in a person. Udvarim Rabim, and there are many such things. Mina hazayot halalu v'habilbulim. Things of this level of nonsense and confusion. He calls them hazayot and bilbulim. He says this is all messed up. It's all confused. It's a non-Jewish thing. It's been taken up by Jews and it does not belong in Judaism. And he's very against it. Okay? So it was obviously doing the rounds when Rav Saadia Gaon was alive, because he talks about it and he says there are people, there are Jews that think this, or people who call themselves Jews, he says, and he's very against it. Rav Saadia Gaon's opinion did not win the day. If you stand up and say this in front of most Jews today, they'll either say, I can't believe anyone said that. Yeah, and you say, oh, it's Rav Saadia Gaon. Well, we don't pass him like that. Which, by the way, raises a very interesting question, which I think I'll just throw out as perhaps the biggest question is there a psak? Is there a ruling in Hashkafa? This should really be a whole course. In Halacha, there is a ruling. In Halacha, there's a system. There's a Gemara, or many Gemaras, and there's analysis. And then we come to a Psak, either because the local Rav would pass it in this way, or now the Shulchan Aruch is very influential. So it's not legit for you to go looking back into, oh, Rabbi, I found this opinion in the Laws of Shabbos in the Ritva from the 1300s, 30th century, and he says you can do this on Shabbos, so we're all going to do this on Shabbos. That's completely not legit, because we can turn around and say, well, that's very nice, there are all sorts of opinions. We can go through Halach and look at all the rejected opinions and the suggested opinions. If we don't pasken that way, we don't pasken that way. You can't heat up your soup on Shabbos morning just because you decided that the Rambam says you can heat up soup on Shabbos morning. Okay, the Yemenites pasken like the Rambam, that's nice. But the Shulchan Aruch does not pasken like the Rambam, and we don't pasken like the Rambam, and you can't heat up soup on Shabbos. So you can turn around and say, yeah, the Rabbi, there's an opinion that says you can. It's irrelevant. You can't just follow random opinions. There's a system. Okay? Fine. Is that true of Hashkafa? Is it true that, well, now we paskin like the Mekubalim? And therefore, we have to believe in Gilgal. And Gilgal, and all the rabbis today believe in Gilgal. And the fact that Rav Sajagon, 1,000 years ago, 1,200 years ago, said, no, Jews don't believe in Gilgal, we've ruled against them. And it's not legit for you to stand up and say, well, Rav Sajagon didn't believe in Gilgulim. Is that correct or not? Or do we say, when it comes to Israel of Hashgafa, it's not a halakhic issue, and maybe one can take different positions on this, and maybe if, you know, that's what an opinion says, maybe that's an opinion you can connect with. This is a very, this itself is a very big debate. A very, very big debate. You had a question?
Yeah.
Go on.
What is Kabbalah, like, which status does Kabbalah have? Is it also as divinely inspired as...
Depends on who you ask. Most people will turn around and say that Kabbalah is based... I mean, there's no question that the Arizal and the people before him and the people after him were completely connected to the system of Masorah. That's for sure. But it doesn't work in the same way as Halacha. Meaning, if I walk out of a room and say, I had a vision from God, and God has explained to me how this halachic issue works... I will not be legitimized. I will be told, I'm sorry, lo b'shamayim hi. What's the pasuk here? Lo b'shamayim hi. At the end of the Torah, you can't go pulling down new things from heaven. We have a system, we have a Torah, we have mitzvahs, we have Gemara, we have analysis. Even a prophet, says the Rambam, even a Navi cannot rule in a halacha based on their nevuah. They're a Navi sheker. We don't do that. With Kabbalah, it's not like that. With Kabbalah, they have ongoing revelation. It doesn't stop at Sinai. It's an ongoing thing. Now, you can decide, well, do I trust that? Am I interested in that? Does it make sense to me? Do I believe that? You can have that discussion, but it's not the same. They don't have Lo B'Shamayim. So when you say divinely inspired, they'll go even further. They'll say, no, God is speaking to these people and revealing more of these ideas. And if not for the fact that when you look at it, it makes so much sense, you might say, well, I don't know if I trust that. When you see it, it actually looks unbelievable. And you think to yourself, you can't make this stuff up. Like there are people, for example, with the Zohar. People will say, you know, Rav Shimon bar Yochai didn't write it. Okay, so who wrote it? So people will say, oh, it's Rav Moshe de Leon. Rav Moshe de Leon was a Spanish writer in the late 1200s. He wrote it. We've got stuff that Rav Moshe de Leon wrote. There is no way in the world that he could have come up with something as enormous, fantastic, and integrated as the Zohar. He just wasn't up to it. Must be from somewhere else. Can't be from him. So I say that about Kabbalah as well. I mean, that Zohar is Kabbalah. So are you allowed, is kind of what I'm asking, to say, well, I don't want to be a Kabbalist. Or are we passing against that now? That's a really interesting question. And that's a little bit of a Hashgafic debate today within the Hashgafic world. The Haredi world believes there's a Psak in Hashgafa, and the non-Haredi world believes there is no Psak in Hashgafa. There's no such thing as Psak in Hashgafa. And that's one of the issues on which these Hashgafas disagree. You ever come across this before? This is actually quite an important point, which I don't want to get into now because it'll take us into a different place. But the issue of Gilgulim is a nice example of it. Rav Sajagon, I'm telling you, if you stand up and say this to Rav Sajagon at the Shabbos table, people will be shocked and horrified. And if they admit that it exists, they'll say, well, we don't pass him that way. Which raises the question, like, you know, is there such a thing? Is that a thing? Or is that not a thing? You should know that in the Yemenite community, who are very into the Rambam, there is one stream of the Yemenite community who are super Kabbalistic. Actually, that sounds like something from Mary Poppins, doesn't it? Super Kabbalistic. Super Kabbalistic esoteric notions. Okay, fine. We'll get there. We'll get there. Okay. And there's another part of the Yemenite community who are unbelievably non-Kabbalistic, who want Kabbalah out of everything. Out of Halacha, out of Hashgafa, completely, completely against it. The Yemenites themselves have these two very extreme... So that Kabbalah can be quite kind of triggering in all sorts of directions. Okay? I'm not going to get into more about it than that. But in Gilgulin, it's certainly there. And I brought you in the Mishnah Berurah. It's absolutely mainstream that all... Certainly Chassidut. Chassidut is completely focused on Gilgulin. And certainly Kabbalah. And the Mishnah Berurah, who was the Litvak, obviously, but the Litvak's also, the Vilna Gaon was a Kabbalist, he writes there are people on Yom Kippur afternoon. You know when it's getting really heavy on Yom Kippur afternoon and you're going through that kind of the dip of the day of Yom Kippur, when it's not yet near enough to the end that you feel the lift and you're just completely... He says there are people on Yom Kippur afternoon that just give up. And they say, you know what, God, I'm just a nasty Rosha. I'm a wicked person. I'm never going to fix it. I'll do it next time. Just next time around. Next Gilgul, okay, it'll be better. But this Gilgul is all messed up, okay? I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. He says, don't think that way. Because, you know how much of a stress and a hassle it is to have to die and come back all over again as a Gilgul? He says, you don't want that. You don't need that kind of bother. Get it right now. Finish it off now. Be better in this life and don't bank on the next Gilgul. Okay, fine. So there's no question that Gilgulim is central. And again, it does go into Gilgulim. But the animals in the Api Kabbalah, Shechita was very much to elevate animals who actually had the souls of people in them that would be fixed up by the Shechita. You can go far down the rabbit hole as you want. Yes?
Are we waiting for Mashiach to come until like all the souls have
So one of the things that Kabbalah says, the Arizal says, is that all the souls that were part of the original super soul of Adam Arishon have to come down and go through all their Gilgulim, and when the last ones have gone through that, that's when Mashiach can come. But that's a process which is ongoing. Okay.
And there's some that have
I don't know. Don't ask me specifics because I don't know specifics. Yes.
So if we are recycled souls,
it's 3 o'clock.
Then Tichyat HaMeitim, who are we coming back as?
Which Gilgul? Nice question.
Yeah.
Nice question. You see, for the Rambam, he kind of doesn't need Gilgulim because Tchias HaMeisim is the ultimate Gilgul, the uber Gilgul, yeah, the Gilgul on steroids, you know? It's a good question. I don't know. You have to ask the Kabbalists and see. Maybe a mix of all. Fine. I want you to just look for finally on page 16. Because I summarized for you a little bit according to everything we've said. Summary 1 and summary 2. How do we understand that the world works? So, if you look here, summary 1, let's look at two different tracks. What do we understand the destiny of the world is? Something sort of small and light, like the destiny of the world. According to Maimonides, this is how it works, guys. This world, physical, natural Yemosa Mashiach, okay, the world will become to peace, but it'll be natural. Temporary resurrection, people will come back to life, but only for a short time and they'll die. And the ultimate goal is spiritual Olam Haba. And the goal of the world is for people to get to Olam Haba, reconnect with God. For the Ramban, for the Kabbalists, for Nachmanides, it's this world. And then a supernatural Yemosa Mashiach, leading to an eternal resurrection, which is this physical and spiritual together. Does he believe in Olam Haba, the soul world? Yes, but only as a holding zone. It's a holding zone when you die before the final kind of Mashiach resurrection thing happens. In terms of the original, the individual soul, so the Rambam will say, what happens to you and me? So the Rambam will say, we're alive. We've never been here before, said the Rambam. We were alive. And then we die. And then our soul goes up to Gan Eden, where it's judged and it'll have whatever we made it to have. Then maybe there'll be a temporal resurrection, not everyone has to forget it, but there'll be a temporal resurrection, after which we die, and then go back to the ultimate Olam Haba. And that temporal resurrection, as I say, is for people to do better the second time round. That's how it works. For the Ramban, what you have is life, death, soul world, and I should say you should probably be stuck in a loop there for Gilgulim. Life, death, life, death, life, death, life, death, life, death, life, death, okay? And eventually, at the end of the whole process, an eternal resurrection, Olam Haba, which is this physical, spiritual world all together. Okay? I'm sure it's more complicated than this, but maybe this gives you a little bit of an overview of how this works. Now, I'll take some questions for a few minutes and then we'll finish. Yes?
Do they say anything about there being a certain amount of time? Like, if a person is going to come back as a Gilgul, it typically happens within a certain amount of
time. I don't know any details.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I'm not an expert in any sense on this issue. I mean, the amount of study that one has to do to get one's head properly into Kabbalah is decades upon decades upon decades. Mm-hmm. It's an unbelievable. It's like starting all over again as a first grader. Really is. Any other questions now? Anything about anything to do with Mashiach? Everyone's happy. Everyone's resolved everything. Yes. Emunah Borg.
Thank you. I still don't really stop the idea of life. So you get there's the resurrection of the dead.
Yes.
And then you get to let's say it comes before Mashiach.
As I said, the Rambam is open to resurrection being before,
so,
during, or after.
If it comes before, during, or after. Does Mashiach have an after?
That's a good question. Well, Mashiach, according to the Rambam, will die, and then there'll be the son of Mashiach, the grandson of Mashiach, the great-grandson of Mashiach, and we'll go on from there.
Well, that makes sense.
Okay. Not according to the Ramban. According to the Ramban, once we get into Mashiach, it's all, we're all forever.
It says people continue to die, right? Life is like
normal. That's according to the Ramban,
yeah. How does resurrection happen? If everyone's resurrected before, do they also die eventually? Do they resurrect as children? Do they die?
You're good.
Like, if you're 100 years old when you get resurrected, will you die the next day?
Okay, so I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. And that, they are the kind of questions they threw at the Ramban when he had this position. They said, well, you don't take this seriously. You don't really believe in resurrection. You think we're going to die again. We're going to live for a day, a week. He's not interested in answering those questions. Because he says, what you need to do is realize that Olam Haba, the soul world, is what you need to be focused on. That's the world where you really connect with God. This world is just a prep zone. And if you get another bite of this world, that's lovely. But if you, it's Olam Haba that's the key. Yes.
Correct.
That's why they asked on the Rambam, according to you, what is the point of resurrection? What is the point?
Yeah.
Because the whole goal is the next world. So why would you get all the way up there and then get schlepped back down into this world again? And that's why they said, that's why we think you don't really believe in resurrection. We think you mean it means life after death. And he denied it and denied it and denied it and denied it and denied it, as we said. But you're right. I mean, I suggested that it's worth coming back just to have a week, a day, a month. I don't know. You could do a lot with that. But it's not totally clear. The Kabbalistic system seems to be much clearer. Yes?
I guess that was related to my question, but like, I get why you learn this stuff, because like, there's an importance of praying for Mashiach and all this stuff. But I feel more confused. Like, what am I supposed to be looking towards?
Okay, so what you feel is more complex.
Yeah.
Okay, and the confusion, what you need to do is you need to kind of work through that complexity and work out, like, where does that leave me? So I would say that the bottom line where it leaves you is as follows. The one thing everybody agrees on, and this is perhaps the most important thing, all of the details at the end of the process is very, you know, interesting, but actually quite irrelevant to you and me today. What everybody agrees on, every opinion that we've seen and every opinion that there is that this world is a place that you need to fix. Fix yourself, fix the world.
Whether you're a Kabbalist and you're doing Tikkun and you're fixing yourself and you're fixing the cosmic world, that's brilliant. Whether you're the Rambam and you're not a Kabbalist but you're fixing the world and making it into a better and better place where people can live together and being able to do mitzvahs and daven and learn and come to... Either way, that is the message you get out of this. Everyone agrees that unlike
the non-Jewish world, which classically the Greek world, either said there's no point trying to fix anything or it's too hard to fix anything. Think about it. Most people in the world, they just go through, they go, you know, they go to work so that they can earn money, so that they can have a holiday, so they can, you know, relax a bit, so they can go back to work. And okay, not everybody's life is meaningless. A lot of people have very, very meaningful lives and family. You don't have to be Jewish to have a meaningful life. But Mashiach is instilling in every single Jewish person this idea is that you must not be satisfied with what you've achieved so far. You need to achieve and the world needs you to achieve much more. I say that is the takeaway that everyone agrees on. And don't just turn around and say, Hashem will bring Mashiach. That is not okay. That is not okay because that absolves yourself of responsibility. And a lot of people do that. Hashem will work everything out. Yeah? That's not how we're meant to live.
How do we know we're supposed to bring him? He's not just supposed to come at a certain time.
Like, what's the difference? What you're doing is you are doing what you can do in this world to create, to make yourself and this world a place which is more perfected. So,
also, sorry, one more question. What's the whole thing that he's supposed to come by a certain time? Maybe I missed it.
Okay, so we don't believe in that, says the Rambam. We don't believe that Mashiach is meant to come by a certain time. Even, and I hate to burst your bubble, even the whole 6,000 thing,
yeah, that's what I was talking
about. Is not necessarily something that is fundamental to Judaism. Everybody's very fixated on this idea that Mashiach has to come by the year 6,000.
Yeah.
Like, there's one opinion, a Midrashic opinion in the Gemara, that the world is made of 2,000, 2,000, 2,000, like three sets of years. There's a story, I don't know if it's true or not, that they asked the Chofetz Chaim, what would you do if the year 6,000 came in and Mashiach hadn't come yet? And he looked at them and he said, I daven Maariv. Like, what do you want me to do? Like, be a Buddhist? Like, I daven Maariv. I just get on with it. About 50 years ago, Rav Shimon Schwab, a very important thinker in America, in Breuers, in the Upper West, in Washington Heights, from Germany originally, he wrote an essay where he was very bothered all of his life by the fact that there were 164 years missing from the calendar in the Second Temple period. Mm-hmm. This is something that we Jews have been talking about, again, for 1,000 years. It's not something new. And he came up with this whole essay about the fact that the actual year in the calendar is not 5, like today, 5, 7, 8, 6, mm-hmm. but 164 years after that. So it'll be, what, 5, 9, 6, 5 something. Yeah? And everyone screamed and shouted, you can't say that, you can't say that, because then the year 6,000 is like 45 years away, and everyone's going to freak out. Okay, so then he said, okay, I'm not going to say it, whatever, fine. So, I don't know, it might not even be the year 5, 7, 8, 6. It might be the year 5, 9, 5 something. Does that change your life? I don't think you should fixate on these things. Because what happens is people get more and more kind of dependent on them as a crutch, and then they get let down, and I just don't think it's necessary. And they miss the key point, which is you've got to be better today, not wait for Hashem's going to bring Mashiach. Yeah.
Is it fully possible to do everything that you're supposed to do in this world without knowing what it is that Hashem means to you?
Oh, that's a very deep question. I mean, it really is. I mean, you can't obviously do every mitzvah, because to do every mitzvah you need to be a Kohen and a non-Kohen and a man and a woman. And we have to do them together as Jewish people. But you have to do everything you can do. Okay? How much can you do? I don't know, but it's almost certainly a lot more than you think you can do. I mean, that's the only thing, that's my experience of life, you know? So, yeah.
You know how, so you said that Kabbalah unlocks a lot of different things.
Yes, yes.
Reason, but not everyone's in the Kabbalah.
Yes.
Isn't there like some sort of danger of learning Kabbalah?
Overplayed. Not really. That's a bit fake news. This idea you have to be 40 to learn Kabbalah, that's not true. There's danger if you're going to start writing amulets and doing magic and all that kind of stuff. But nobody's doing that anymore, honestly. So there's no danger in learning Kabbalah. On the contrary, I think it's important that you do learn Kabbalah. And Chassidus basically brings Kabbalah into the mainstream. What Chassidus, by the way, does is it brings all of these unbelievably complex ideas, all of the kind of computer programming of Kabbalah, brings it into the human psyche and tells you how it makes a difference to you as an individual. That is the beauty of Chassidus, that it takes the complexity of Kabbalah and turns it into a self-analysis. Chassidus is a 19th century phenomenon. It could only have been a post-revolutionary, modern-day phenomenon. It's all about the individual. It's all about your self-realization. Nobody thought that way in the year 1500. In the 1800s, they felt that way. Chassidus is a product of its times, very much. And it's brilliant. Yes. I mean, you can have the last word, Kandora.
Oh, thank you. So I have heard of you about the idea of Mashiach coming and also Gog Magog.
Yes.
This final war or tribulation,
yes,
that's going to,
yes,
happen. So I've heard that Mashiach can come in two different ways. Number one is if we bring him,
yes,
by through our mitzvot, right?
Yes.
To basically self-actualize as a nation so much that Hashem is like, oh wow, the Jewish people really deserve Olam Haba. However, yes, and if that happens, then we kind of skip Gog Magog, and
yes,
it's not that consequential.
Yeah, we saw that explicitly.
And the opposite is that we continue on our path.
Yes.
And Mashiach comes very violently, and Gog Magog does come, and then,
yes,
two-thirds of the world die.
Okay, I don't know where you got that number from, but okay.
I don't know, but
sounds a bit
where
extreme,
does
but okay.
That worldview fall in? Like, is it mainstream? Or?
All of these worldviews can be sourced in the Tanakh. You can read the book of Daniel and come up with an apocalyptic worldview. You can read the book of Yeshayahu. I mean, look at the prophecy to Yechezkel of the dry bones. You know, the bones, he prophesy over these dry bones where there are literally the dried out remains of the Jewish nation living there. And he says, prophesy, and then they come together and they get up as an army and they're ready to go. Now, that on the one hand is a moshul for that the Jewish people as a religion, as a nation, even though they're finished and their people write them off, They'll come back and they'll rebuild, etc. But is it also an actual chat thing that there are people who are going to come back? It could be. So all of this is built into the Tanakh. The idea, guys, that there's one Jewish view on something is very simplistic. I know you're not saying this. And therefore, the idea that there are two, maybe three, maybe four, maybe five ways of looking at it is built into anything complex. I'll leave you with this thought. You know, Lahavdil, when you're reading Shakespeare, yeah, you're reading a Shakespeare sonnet. So, and you have an English literature exam, and they say, you know, Shakespeare writes, shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. And he goes through this whole thing. And in your English literature exam, they say, what is Shakespeare alluding to in this sonnet? If you just write down, you read it and think, well, he's out in the park with his girlfriend, and that's what it is. And you write that, you get like, nul point. You get no points. You are going to fail all your exams. What you're meant to say is, no, Shakespeare is an incredibly complicated writer. He's obviously alluding the summer's... I'm making all this up now. The summer's day obviously alludes to Macbeth, Act 3, Scene 2, where the summer's... You know what I mean? You have to bring all this in. Was Shakespeare able... Yeah, Shakespeare was unbelievable. When Shakespeare wrote three lines, he was bringing in ideas from a million different places. Okay, good. That's how literature works. The Torah is meant to be more complex or less complex than Shakespeare?
More.
Right. A divinely authored text is going to have infinitely more texture in it and the ability to bring things out of it than Shakespeare. So why are we kind of lulled into this idea that, well, there has to be like one Jewish view and that's all and everything else is just confusing? In order to be real, it has to be complex. And if it's not complex, then you're basically saying the text is simplistic and, you know, and Tom, Dick and Harry could have written it, which is not what we believe. Yeah? And therefore, absolutely built into Mashiach as these two different ideas. Constantly, we do it this way, then this. And maybe that's true. Everything is dependent on our choices. You know, God's got an infinite number of futures mapped out, and all of them depend on how we make our choices on a day-to-day basis. So, correct. Many people have said that Gog or Magog might never happen. Maybe already happened. But the point is not trying to predict it. Oh, I think the Second World War was Gog or Magog. I think the Spanish Inquisition. It's trying to just kind of look. I don't know how any of the details work. I know one thing is I need to be a better Jew today, and that will be part of the solution, not part of the problem, ultimately. I gave her the last word. Oh. But go on then. You can have the postscript.
So, if we know that it's all infinitely complex.
Yes.
And that there's no one doing anything.
No, there are some things, like you're not allowed to murder people for fun. It's very clear. There are lots of things on which we can agree on, but we can't necessarily agree on everything. So, yes.
13 Icarim. Like,
this what?
13 Icarim. Why are we saying
I don't
this?
Know what word you're saying.
Icarim.
Oh, 13 Icarim.
Yeah.
Yes, okay. Yeah, good.
There's 13 things that yes. are not all given in the Torah that we're being told we all have to believe.
Okay, and by the way, we go back to that's a good segue into the very beginning of the course, which we'll restart in Forsman, which is that a lot of people were very annoyed with the Rambam for saying there were 13 Ikarim. Mm-hmm. There aren't 13 Ikarim. You can't just bring down 13 things that you have to believe in, everything else is like chopped liver. Mm-hmm. There were many people that said there are 613 Ikarim. Mm-hmm. There were a million Ikarim. So,
belief in Mashiach is not in the Chumash.
It's not so clear that it's not in the Chumash, actually. The Rambam is pretty on solid ground when he says that they prophesy the coming of an age which will be, a golden age. I think that is pretty clear.
I do quite like the prophecy given this portion.
There's more in the Mashiach, there's more in the Chumash about Mashiach than there is about Olam Haba.
Okay,
but that's a whole other discussion. All right, ladies, what I've tried to do is give you... Oh, you want to have a picture. Rachel wants to have a picture. Am I taking the picture?
No, you're in the picture.
Oh, I'm in the picture.
Whoever doesn't want to be friends with you or doesn't want to be in it, take the picture. Okay.
Okay.
Whoever would like to be in a picture, never be in it, come into the picture.